Welcome to Friday. Welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This week we are coming to you from the Carco Theater in Renton. What a beautiful city, Renton. The city logo features an airplane, a football, and a salmon. The airplane, of course, for the Boeing plant, making 737s right on the shore of Lake Washington. Not a bad view for an industrial factory. The football is for the Virginia Mason Athletic Center, the VMAC, where the Seahawks train, practice, draft players, and draw up game plans, like throwing the ball from the 1 yard line in the Super Bowl on second down with 26 seconds left and Marshawn Lynch standing right there available to run with the ball into the end zone. But we don't blame Renton for that. And of course, the salmon in the logo represents what used to be in the Cedar River. Speaking of which, Renton is home to the state's coolest library. Now, I know when Seattle Central Library opened, the New York Times called it a blazing chandelier to swing your dreams upon, an urban montage of starburst images, and the library that puts on fishnets and hits the disco. But is Seattle's library over a river? No, it is not. So that's no contest. Renton is home to Wizards of the Coast. Jimi Hendrix lived here and is buried here at Greenwood Cemetery. And did anyone here know that in 1949, Clint Eastwood was a lifeguard at Kennydale Beach? Absolutely true. He was a lifeguard there where he was known to tell misbehaving swimmers, "I know what you're thinking. Did he blow his whistle 6 times? Or only 5. I lost track, but I do know that running, spitting, and horseplay are prohibited. And bathers with open wounds are advised not to use the beach. Would you like an open wound, punk?" That's my award-winning Clint Eastwood impression, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much. On with the show. It gets even better than that Clint Eastwood impression. Please welcome our panel today, Monica Guzman, co-founder of the Evergrey Newsletter. Monica, welcome. Charles Mudede, a writer for the Seattle Stranger. Charles, come on out. Rachel Lerman, a tech writer for the Seattle Times. Hi, Rachel. How are we, team? Good?
Doing good.
Shall we get at it?
Yeah.
Okay. This is the hour of the week where we get to spend a little time together and figure out what happened this week and what it all means. First of all, what happened Friday night at SeaTac Airport? An airline worker stole a Horizon Air turboprop plane, not a little Cessna, a 78-seat passenger plane from the cargo area of the tarmac, and he flew it for more than an hour, pulling off aerobatic maneuvers that have experts wondering how he learned to do it. Was this a hijacking, terrorism, idiocy, a joyride? Well, the person who made this YouTube video seemed to see it as a poetic swan song from someone who was too magnificent for this world.
I got a lot of people that care about me, and it's gonna disappoint them to hear that I did this. I would like to apologize to each and every one of them. I'm slowly drifting to a broken guy, got a few screws loose, I guess. Never really knew it until now.
That is not a drill.
I just want you to whisper between nothing in my ear.
So that was a YouTube sort of tribute video. Of course, that man, Richard Russell, fatally ran that plane down into an island in South Puget Sound. Some of the comments at this YouTube site ran along the lines of, "In memoriam, Richard Sky King Russell. He went out on his own terms. Rules and personal safety be damned. A modern Icarus." Charles, Charles has his head in his hand. And you wrote about the modern Icarus in The Stranger. What was this whole episode about to you?
Oh, it was hard to. The video we just watched is very difficult for me to
I have a very negative opinion about what happened. I want to just be honest about that. Are we that desperate for heroes right now? Is this what we've come to? I mean, how in the world is this at all heroic? This total act of stupidity, right? And I'm not going to be nice about it. I know people want to say that he had mental issues and so forth and so on, that's fine. I agree. You can actually bring up that point. But to make him a hero and an expression of American self-determination and ignoring the great danger he put a lot of people into, I mean, what would happen if your child lost their lives because of this stunt? I mean, to me, it's unfathomable. Like, I don't understand how in the world you begin to memorialize this act. Maybe it's beyond me because, you know, I'm wondering maybe I'm not American enough or something. For me, doing this kind of thing usually is kind of like bad from top to bottom. I mean, it's hard for me to see eye to eye with the American individualistic perspective. Damn the laws, right? Damn the rules. Do what you want. Okay, all right, so. What about if your child died in this incident?
More to say about all of that. Monica, what was the episode about to you, and what do you think of Charles's take?
I mean, not cool with the heroics, for sure. But I get the attempt to try to bring meaning to something that was so harrowing. I don't know, how many of you all heard this as it was going on Friday night. I did. I was watching the tweet stream, and there was one quote. So Richard Russell was talking with an air traffic controller, throughout the flight, and people could hear it. And the quote that stopped me on my tracks, and I think stopped a lot of people, was about, I know that there's a lot of people who love me, and I guess I'm just a broken guy with a few screws loose, and I didn't realize it until now. I mean, I remember the first time I read that, it was one of those moments on the internet where you're used to kind of scrolling past things and absorbing fairly significant things quickly, but I just stopped. And I also know that there's a lot of people that night who watched the footage over and over again, who sat and tried to imagine this person's state of mind. So I get the attempt to try to bring something out, something good, maybe, out of something so painful and hard, but weirdly relatable. Weirdly like, oh my God, right, life is crazy.
How could you relate to that?
I mean, I had it written in my notes, something that I wasn't sure I was, gonna say live, which is just that life really is crazy, and life really is hard, and we often look for clear telltale signs of things gone wrong, right? Well, he was so well-liked, and he seemed so normal, and he seemed so happy, but, what does that really say? Anything can happen. Any of us can go through those moments. Lucky enough to be a fairly happy person, but...
I'm sorry, I'm gonna say this. I have to say this.
Say it.
Even before we go into other sides, Americans and so forth and so on, imagine if that person had been a white woman who'd done this stunt. I mean, I don't believe there would have been the same response at all. Well, I was just speaking with a white woman. Imagine a 28-year-old white woman steals a plane. I mean, the kind of language we'd hear, would you see this video? No, it's like, oh my God, the bitch is nuts. What's she doing in the sky? I'm just telling you, this is what that would have been the first thing out of people's heads. There wouldn't be hero, fly guy, sky man. There's no sky woman. It's the nutty, batty, crazy in the sky. And that's what we would be saying. And I'm just saying, I just can't stand. I just start with white women. Let's go down from that. Let's go to others, and we know, it's gonna get worse. Mm-hmm. Whoever else is in the sky, and not this white kid, young man, I'm just saying. I'm going to say it. I leave it there. I'm going to move on.
I do wonder if people are, not necessarily relating to him, but trying to relate to him. Like, do people see this? Do some people see this? And I don't get it either, I agree. But do some people see it and think, wow, so impressive. How could you do such a feat like that? Are they trying to make themselves relate to him more than they actually do?
Yeah, yeah. Trying to find that connection, maybe a justification for the allure, maybe the primeval kind of weird allure that people might feel toward events like this.
Yeah, I was surprised to see these videos, though, because that was not my first reaction.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, nor mine. I didn't really get... First, I read Charles's piece, The Modern Icarus, and then I saw this video, and then I saw comments like, he was too good to live among us. Rise forever,
oh,
Sky
Lord.
King. Another one. I don't have words, but I've been crying all day with a big smile on my face. Wherever you are, Bebo... That was his nickname. Wherever you are, Bebo, I hope you are together with that baby orca.
Why do we have to bring the whale into it?
He brought it up, right? He said he wanted to see the mom with the orca.
He also brought up that he was, you know, he couldn't, you know, I think the air controller said to him, you know, if you come back down, we'll get you a job as a pilot. And he says, nah, you know, I'm a white guy. That's not going to happen, right? Yeah. And I was like, whoa, where is this guy coming from? I heard it's Wasilla, but you know, it's just like it's like what is he saying by that? Some people were caught by the other stuff. That gave me pause.
You mentioned the American idea of, you know, go it alone.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that a solely American idea of there's this element of he put the system on trial. You know, they couldn't catch him. They couldn't plan out his last moments. He did it his way. Is that just an American thing? And flying? Do any of you dream of flying?
No, terrified. No, never.
I do.
No,
I dream
really?
Of flying.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Like
no.
With in a plane or with wings?
A little of both. thank you for
I'll
asking.
I'll take like dream like no. flying. I'll take no. that. No. I'll take superhero flying.
I don't have to flap in my dreams. It's more of a
soaring.
It's more of just I can feel the air getting underneath the lift.
Okay.
And it just yeah. And when I'm in a plane, which I occasionally am, then it has to do with navigating things in the sky, like wires and things. Mm. But this guy, he flew free. There were no wires, man. It was him in the sunset. I'm just asking, is that a relatable, if ridiculous, thing?
I mean, how do I benefit from that? What do I get out of this? Right?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Right? So, okay, that's his thing. You know, I wanted to say, I hate flying, everybody. I hate it. But I figured out how to fly without worrying about it. What you have to do is, when you're taking off, imagine that your plane is being chased by Nazis, and they're going to kill you. And so when the plane takes off, you're really relieved. Because you're like, I got away. It works every time.
From Charles Mudene.
But everybody who was interviewed, a lot of people in the press, not even going to the comments, a lot of people who were interviewed, this is also in Alaska, where he came from, I think it was the Anchorage Daily News, did a really interesting story about his time in high school and so on. And then there was a story also about people who worked with him at SeaTac, and sort of the motif was that he was really a nice guy, was like, oh, I knew him. He was just a normal guy. He was a nice guy. And, oh, you know, I'm really shocked. You know, he enjoyed life. He enjoyed work. But nobody, I mean, you have to admit that those opinions are proven wrong, right? Like,
well,
you didn't.
I don't know that it needs to be either or. Like, can you be happy? Can you have a normal experience in high school? Can you be popular? And can you... you know, have mental health problems, have issues, have some sort of, you know, incident where suddenly you do something like this. Like, does it have to be one or the other?
Mm-hmm. I think we always, yeah. Yeah. We look for explanations, we look for consistency. Mm-hmm. You know, this person was always this way, this was waiting to happen, but life is a lot more random than that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even with the airport itself, right? Like, the security officials, everyone's trying to figure out, you know, how do you patch the hole here? But, my gosh, there's been, you know, lots of flights and lots of, you know, things going on at airports with this never happening. And people call it the one in a million thing. I mean, it's weird, right? Because if you accept that life is random, then there's nothing to do, right? So you want to give that explanation so that you can say, this is where it went wrong. This is what we could have done differently. This is how we could have noticed from before. But could we?
And can we transfer our reactions to other things? I wondered if you're upset about property crime, you know, think about that property crime that you empathized with. Or if you're upset about immigrants not following the rules, think about the rule breaker who, you know, made you cry with a smile on your face. You know, that rather than calling people out as hypocrites, kind of that, yeah, we're all irrational. We're all looking, you know, we project our own story. I saw a comment, you showed, rest in peace, Rich, you showed mankind how corporate greed can break a hardworking man, try to feed his family with peanuts. So you're learning about the writer, you know, and that's human. That's kind of how we all process
exactly.
Stuff.
We're all reflecting something, projecting
something. First of all,
we
don't use the word mankind anymore.
Sorry.
No. There's women as well.
Yes. Well,
I guess so.
As an editor, I would have changed.
You would strike
that.
Humankind.
Say humankind. How about that?
Airplanes no longer serve peanuts.
That's true.
Yes. Good point.
Let's be accurate.
A bunch of journalists doing an edit on people's reaction to an extraordinary event on the Week in Review. Well, we will we'll learn more about him. I don't know that we'll learn anything particularly important, but the FBI is investigating, and we'll hear more. And you're listening to The Week in Review. You will hear more out of this show with Charles Medetti and Monica Guzman and Rachel Lerman. We're going to be right back. When we come back, is it getting smoky in here? Stay tuned. This week, we learned that air quality in the Seattle area was worse than what world capital?
Beijing.
I would have also accepted Calcutta, Mumbai, and Los Angeles, because it was worse than all of those places. Of course, I'm talking about this week's cloak of smoke.
The entire state of Washington woke up in a blanket of haze this morning.
And David, this is all smoke from Canada.
Yeah.
It really is. It's hard to believe.
Kenworthy says data isn't clear enough to show whether it was the worst day for any one city. He predicts air quality could be better this weekend before worsening again next week.
Hey, the smoke could get better and then back next week. Rachel, what did our smoke blanket say to you?
Yes, I'm glad you asked, because I really want to talk about Smokey the Bear, or as I've recently learned, his proper name is Smokey Bear. There's no the.
There's no
really?
The.
There's no the. Yeah, I know.
Again, we're editing the news.
Yeah, yeah.
As only journalists.
Childhood lied to me.
Yeah.
So Smokey Bear was this, creation during the, I believe it was the 70s, 60s?
I found a video as far back as the 50s.
Wow, okay, the 50s.
It was a much longer form video back then. Wow. Smokey told the story of the three little humans. You should check it out. It's online. But yes, Smokey Bear.
So the message
I'm not kidding, by the way. It's like a five-minute fairy tale about fire.
So Smokey taught us that the worst thing that you can do is start forest fires, right? Like, that is what I took from Smokey Bear. Do not start forest fires. Be very careful that you don't. I was reading some really interesting pieces this week that said, well, actually, that's wrong. Because what we've done now is we haven't set enough forest fires. And the forests are so dense and just so full of brush that every time a wildfire, which happens, every time they start, they just take off like crazy. And so we're getting worse and worse and bigger fires, and our woodland firefighters, our systems are not set up for this. And I don't think that we can ignore climate change's effect on this, but I do think it's interesting that something that we've been told forever is, you know, it's a little bit off, it's a little bit wrong. Controlled burns are necessary and even helpful to help control the wildfires.
Yeah, but there were was much more grassland. I was learning, and much less forest land before Europeans came here. There were more huge trees that could survive fire and insects and disease. Monica?
Yeah, I mean, last year we had this too, right, for longer. And I remember last year's smoke, it being kind of, you know, sort of novel and interesting, obviously concerning to me. This year, I'm just like, no, what? No. oh. And I was thinking of, you know, when there's an oil slick on a puddle in the ground, and it's kind of pretty because it has this shimmery sort of rainbow color, but you know that it's ugly. You know that there's something wrong and gross about it. And that's how I'm looking at, as the sun sets in a smoky day, you get this neon light that kind of lights up the city and lights up trees. And there's something beautiful about it, but also just particularly gross because, you know, the weather, the reason we always talk about the weather and it's such a cliche is because it's universal, it affects us all, but there's nothing we can do about it. There's nothing you can do. So I feel this sort of, I'm being cheated out of the natural beauty that surrounds me. I'm being cheated out of, you know, the most beautiful part of Seattle summer. What?
Yeah, there's so little summer.
So little summer.
I know, and it's just, you know, and the conversations around climate change have gotten a lot more urgent in the last year. I think I at least feel the gravity of it more deeply. And so, you know, you kind of tie it all together and it's just a gloomy, gloomy picture, even though sometimes it can look deceptively beautiful, haunting.
It's interesting, though, because you can actually feel it. I'm so used to the air in Seattle, even when it's, you know, cloudy and gray and drizzly, not rainy, during most of the year. You can walk outside, you can breathe the air, you feel pretty good. And this is awful. I mean, I know that people with asthma have been having problems. It's really hard to walk outside. I'm definitely using it as an excuse not to exercise.
Mm-hmm. Good move.
I mean, yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Well, what about you, Charles?
Oh, man, I'm angry about it all, because I grew up in the 80s. My childhood, really my teenage years, was in the 80s. And that time, there were really two big fears that we were sort of faced with. You know, you're a young man and you're a boy, and it's sort of like the global, potential global catastrophes were two. And one was nuclear war, and the other one was the greenhouse effect. You know, and so it was very present to us what was going on, the ozone layer and this sort of thing. And it seemed like there was a chance that either of these could be averted. So I was, you know, when the Berlin Wall came down, it seemed like that danger had sort of declined a little bit, the nuclear danger. And then I was hoping that something would happen with the climate, that we'd get to somewhere, and we didn't. And so I'm actually getting old enough to see the horrible world, right, that was sort of portrayed to me as a young man. Like, I'm watching it happen. When I see that sunset, it brings me back to the 80s and those kinds of predictions that were made. And I was in Africa, and we knew about it. You know, in high school, we read about this stuff. And so it was not like hidden information. It was something that we were really concerned about. And it's really sad that I've got to this stage to look at a sunset like that.
Well, maybe wildfires are a good thing if they make Western Americans and Canadians actually think of climate change as their problem too.
That's a good way to think about it. I mean, it is a very visual reminder. I mean, we see it, we walk through it. I think that it's been the topic of conversation that I've had with literally everyone that I've talked to this week.
Yeah.
Didn't I read in The Stranger that something about how the wildfire, the forests are burning and climate change is here, and the city of Seattle is delaying its bicycle lanes?
That sounds like something I wrote.
Yeah.
I would change the headline a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because it's even when you're, it was fascinating to drive down say I-5 or even a freeway, and in the smoke, right? And it's just, you know, it's visually impressive to me because you're like, holy moly, look at that, right? I mean, we're here, we're stuck in traffic, right? And we can't see our city.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, and I'm like, wow, you just we've arrived.
And since you're in traffic, you're part of the problem.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I was in a bus actually, so I was.
Yeah. If you
a fraction of the part of the problem.
Yeah, it's a little
piece. I want everybody to know that I can't drive, but I want everybody also know that the reason wasn't that honorable. My father gave me money to learn how to drive, and I used it to produce a rap record. So.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
All right.
That's what I did. That's what
today
I did.
Today I heard
the record?
No, I'm going to burn every copy. Maybe I'll take
it. Wow.
Well, the smoke is in the process of clearing out, and according to the audio we heard earlier, might be back next week. So we'll see
and
about
next
that.
Year,
and the year after that.
And the year after that. And you know what else will be back? The Week in Review. I hope you'll stay tuned. We'll be right back in a moment as we continue to cover the week's news. Thanks for tuning in to the Week in Review. We're here with friends at the Carco Theater in Renton. Last week was the one-year anniversary of the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. This year's anniversary rally in Washington, D.C. drew far fewer white supremacists than counter-demonstrators. This weekend in Seattle, there'll be some kind of rally by the far-right groups Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys. We asked our audience before the show started, do you want the media to ignore that rally, cover that rally? And what I saw was evenly split in this room. Charles, what questions are you asking yourself about rallies and our response?
Yeah, you know, I think they should be covered. I'm not against that. I think it's important that people know that they're happening. I think ignoring them might be dangerous.
Why do you say that?
Because I think a lot of people shouldn't live with the perception that this kind of thing is not going on. I think they have to be aware of it. And if you don't cover it, then you continue thinking that everything's okay, and it's not. A lot of these guys, I've seen the videos where they sort of track them down. They're ordinary, you know, ordinary people. They're in people's, you know, they're there for Thanksgiving and stuff. They got regular jobs. They weren't outsiders. And so it's important for us to see them and to know who they are and to know that this is in the fabric of our society. So I'm opposed to maybe the coverage could change, but I'm not opposed to covering the type of the way we cover.
Mm-hmm. I talked to a journalist from KPFA this week in Berkeley who was advising journalists to not exaggerate the importance of people who can draw, as it turns out, 20 protesters or whatever the number is. There's the tension there.
Mm-hmm. I think I understand why the media has been covering it the way that we have, which is you look at what happened last year in Charlottesville. It was not that long ago. It was huge and deadly and awful, and I think surprising to a lot of people. And so, you know, on this one-year anniversary, I understand the impulse to say, hey, this is happening again. We see the permits. These groups or similar groups are coming, you know, to warn people about and notify them about, hey, this is going to be going on in your city. Here's when, and, you know, there might be violence, things like that. That being said, now that we're seeing, or at least starting to see with what we saw in D.C., that these protests aren't turning out as many people as maybe we thought, it raises a question for me of how much voice do you give to these groups? Because there are protests every day, right? The city has protests every day. Mm-hmm. Most of them are sparsely attended. D.C. certainly has protests on the White House lawn every day. Mm-hmm. And so what do we cover? What do we not? How much weight do you put on these?
Right. Because it's, you know, a society wants to keep deviant things deviant, which means you want to shut it down. You know, if it's not acceptable, you want to show up and you want to shut it down. I mean, there's something about, you know, being outnumbered, right? Like these groups being outnumbered, that's kind of, there's something about that feels right. But I do believe that media attention can skew what's going on. And if something is quite small and it's, you know, some people that just have these ideas and they go out there and the amount of attention creates the, you know, the idea that this is really, really big, then people start to think it's really big. Or the other problem that can happen is negative attention is still attention. And sometimes groups like to exploit this tendency in media to cover anything, right, that seems like it's at a fault line, that seems like it's provocative. And so
that was the Russian theory of deepening our divisions, right? To go at the,
right.
go at the so, divisions and play them up.
So groups can exploit that in the media because they know that they will get covered, and by getting covered, they might reach more deviants, and it can grow. So that, I don't think it's that simple. I don't think it's clear cut. You know, in a dream world, we'd have like somehow this perfect little round table of like, you know, the public and the media, and we'd all figure it out. Like, what do we do? But we can't have that, and so we just play it by ear, and we do the best we can, and we try to assess the situation. We try to minimize harm, because that's ultimately what journalists and media should do: minimize harm, give information people need to know. Charles, I think you're right. People need to know what's going on. How do you cover it so you don't end up feeding it? How do you not end up falling into the trap that often groups try to exploit?
Can I add one wrinkle to this, which is that unlike Charlottesville with the Patriot Prayer Group, you're not going to, well, I don't know what's going to happen, but the group itself is not about swastikas and tiki torches, and in fact, that's what they're presenting the face that they think is going to be a recruitment tool, so that even covering them isn't really covering them. It's covering their PR campaign, which is different from what they really are.
That's interesting.
That's the knock.
Really, how can we reappropriate the tiki torch? That's the really big question. How do we get it back?
You know? You missed the tiki torch, dude.
I missed the nice, innocent tiki torch in your lawn. I can't put it in my lawn anymore. You know? It means something.
Oh, I have a friend who has a dog awful. Named Tiki. It's very unfortunate.
You brought it up here already, the tiki torch. I was like, oh. Yeah. What a disaster. So, it's like, we should just do a total immigrants marching with tiki torches and bring
take
them
back Italy. The tiki. Hashtag take
leave
back
them
the tiki.
Out.
Tweet it.
Tiki
torch. It's a different
out.
Kind of counter protest.
You know, yeah.
We are all tiki torch now.
Yeah. Just reclaim it. You know, I'm always interested in, like, these groups, because most of them are usually, you know, and I noticed that they're, like, white men, young white men who feel, for some reason, and this is an American phenomenon for me, and I've written about it because it fascinates me. Now, they are often against immigrants, and they often feel that white men are, you know, being displaced in jobs and so forth and so on, and opportunities at the universities and so on, and you know, they're fighting for white power. It's very funny to me because if you go and look at the Forbes, 91% of the Forbes 500 corporations are run by white men, right? And you know, if you go down the list, the statistics are pretty much consistent with that power structure. And it's amazing to me that they actually blame the powerless people for their problems. they absolutely believe people with little to no power are the cause of their problems. And literally, there's like white men in power everywhere. And it's just like, they're not doing anything. No, the Somali guy, or that Mexican picking a grape. No, not the guy in the private jet. It's just like, it's amazing. And it's just like, I have to give, I'm serious. I really have to give rich white men credit for convincing poor white men. You know, that they're not their
problem.
Pretty
neat trick.
I mean, I have to have give him an award because yes. This is some true Jedi mind tricks. You know, I am not bothering you. You are not bothering me. I am good to you. You are good to me. Let me go. Let him go. What the Mexican? Oh, sorry, I'll stop. Sorry.
The Stranger talked with a Democratic State Senator, Rebecca Saldana, who said, first of all, if you come calm and disciplined and plan for what you're going to do if you get hit or shoved. And the same lawmaker said, what if we spent that day building a movement trying to see what free speech and respect of humanity can look like? So a range of responses, and we'll report back. I'm talking with Rachel Lerman and Charles Mudede and Monica Guzman. We're rounding up the news of the week. Come on back to the Week in Review. We'll be right back. It's the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm not alone. I'm at the Carco Theater in Renton. Do you think of yourself as in the 8th district or the 9th district? We looked up the actual address of the Carco Theater, and we are in the 9th congressional district. Is that, you think that's wrong? But there are parts of Renton that are in the 8th congressional district. Do you guys just fight about this stuff all the time?
Oh, wow.
Okay, how many for 8th? Give me a cheer. How many in the 9th district? We're in the 8.5 congressional district here, represented by Harry Potter. It's actually like it's an in-between place that we're in right now.
Three quarters. Nine and three quarters.
9th congressional district, represented by Democrat Adam Smith. And in November, Smith is up for re-election against another Democrat and another Smith. Sarah Smith identifies as a Democratic Socialist, a first-time candidate for office, and earlier this week, I discussed the 9th congressional district election with Democratic strategist Kathy Allen and Republican strategist Randy Pepl. Randy said the Democratic Party is pushing itself to the left of the average voter.
Adam Smith used to like to claim that he was a moderate Democrat, and now he's racing so fast to the left that he stumbled and couldn't even get 50% of the vote in this primary. I mean, I think it's stunning that someone who's been around for that long couldn't get to 50% in a district that was drawn for him.
It was drawn for him. Oh, did you hear that? You're usually smarter than that. You know, the fact is it was drawn for anyone but him. I mean, the fact is he's moved into a district that's a whole lot more progressive, a whole lot more left than he's ever represented before.
Charles, you've interviewed Sarah Smith. What'd you find?
Her politics is solid. I had to vote in that district as well, and I voted for her. I did. Not that I dislike Adam Smith that much, but I actually don't dislike him that much. I'm not saying this very well, but you know, this is so. I'm trying to be like middle of the road. It's impossible
diplomatic
to be middle of the road on an issue, because I Adam Smith has done some great stuff and has pretty solid record. I'm for, but I think that we need somebody new, and I think Sarah Smith is interesting because she's young, and we have a Congress that's a touch too old for me. In my taste, and it's their world now. Mm-hmm. It really is, and I just think we need more young representatives, or younger representatives in Congress. I mean, as my leading thought, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like renewal at some point is healthy, right? Yeah. Like, at some point, you kind of have to look around and go, okay, like, what's next? What's coming up next? And this does seem to be going on nationwide. Sort of people going, okay, like, what is next? The Evergrey, the newsletter I run, we write about all kinds of things Seattle. And back in January, one of our readers emailed us just to say, hey, and he's emailed us about a bunch of things before, so it wasn't like specifically like, I just want to tell you about this. But he just said, you really should watch, like, look out for Sarah Smith. I think, like, I met her, she's very impressive. Check it out. And I'm going to read something that he said. She does AMAs on Reddit, meetups in pubs and game shops and coffee shops, as well as schools and libraries. How cool is that? And she has a great dog. Okay, the quality of one's dog does not qualify one for elected office. I know that, but he really is a fantastic dog. Anyway, that really struck me. And then coming into this season and seeing her and how she's, getting comparisons to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez out of New York. And there's these ties being made, right? These connections being made to a sense of renewal, a sense of young people coming in, changing things. Like whether that will actually happen is, we have yet to see, but people seem hungry for something like that.
Yeah, I think it's part of the trend that we've been seeing since the 2016 election, right? Which is people are searching out something new. They don't want politicians that look like the politicians that we've had for the last several decades that we currently have, but I'm not sure they quite know, we quite know what we are looking for. We're just looking for change. Mm-hmm.
Is there going to be national attention about along the lines of a Bernie Sanders candidate won or lost, as there have been in the primaries so far, and would that be deserved? Is this an election about how progressive Democrats should be? Universal health care and job guarantees? And, or do you think it's just going to be local? You know, it's going to come down to candidates and name recognition and get out the vote? And,
I think it also comes down to results, because the attention that we saw on Ocasio-Cortez, right, was because she pulled off what many people saw as a surprise, which her supporters did not see as a surprise, right? Like they say, if you were there, if you were paying attention to her campaign, well, they were gaining steam the entire time. But what many people saw as, oh, hey, unseating a Democrat who was, you know, well-liked and everybody thought was kind of a shoo-in. So I think it comes down to what actually happens in November.
By the way, as for the 8th District, both the Republican and Democratic strategists I talked to said, Dino Rossi's going to win.
Not with this crowd. You know.
If the election were held today in Carco Theater in Renton, it might look very, very different. It's the Week in Review. Charles Medetti is a writer for the Seattle Stranger. Monica Guzman, co-founder of the Evergreen Newsletter. Rachel Lerman is a tech writer for the Seattle Times. And we're not done yet with the Week in Review. Stay tuned. Back with the Week in Review here at the Carco Theater in Renton.
Is this the last game?
The Seattle Mariners head into the weekend 2.5 games out of the playoff race, which is a negative way to put it. Most teams don't make the playoffs in a year. We could be happy they have a winning record. But the bad news is their star pitcher, Felix Hernandez, appears washed up. And the good news is their best cheater is back. After a suspension for taking a banned substance, infielder Robinson Cano returned.
Chance to welcome him back, and he had a big smile on his face, was just excited to be here, and you could tell. And his teammates, even around the cage, were really excited as he hits a solid line drive into left center.
This playoff race is happening as King County decides how much taxpayer money to spend keeping up Safeco Field. Monica, are we once again about to withhold public subsidies from a disgruntled sports team that will leave us for Oklahoma City?
No, you had to bring up that.
Sometimes you don't know it when you're in the middle of it. Is this what's happening?
Oh, man. I mean, it's got, you know, it sounds a little bit like the early chapters of that. Like, we're starting to haggle. We're starting to, you know, get into the nitty-gritty on who spends what on these sports, you know, facilities. But I mean, what strikes me about the whole thing is, you know, the reason that people are wanting to put the brakes on all this money being handed to the Mariners so that they can make, you know, repairs on the field is because some of our officials feel that the money could be better spent other places in our community. And what's really, what's amazing to me about this is it's fairly rare that, to me anyway, like, to think that a sports team would face that kind of scrutiny where, you know, we'd want to look at the money they have and we'd start to question, and there's been calls for, you know, can there be more transparency about just how profitable the Mariners are? Mm-hmm. Can we look at their books? Can we see what's going on here? Because they seem to be doing really well. And I see that just sort of as part of in a lot of ways around our region, we're kind of asking, where is the money and where should it be? Where is the money and where should it be? And with sports, it's amazing to me because sports teams always feel like connected but a little bit removed from the cities they're in. They sometimes it feels like they have like a closer relationship with TV sets, right, than cities per se. I mean, it's an entertainment industry. It's of course part of the community, but it's also kind of over there. It's polished, it's produced. It's something like that. And so this is also to me just, you know, grabbing the baseball bat and bringing it over here and going, you know, maybe there's stuff going on here that we should look at. And so it was really striking to follow the stories about how, you know, people have been changing their minds, people have been asking these questions. So, I mean, it's the beginning of something. I don't quite know where it's going to go.
Specifically, Rachel, in the Seattle Times, your paper, the Mariners and the Stadium Authority are negotiating this 25-year lease deal for Safeco Field. And the Seattle Times quoted one member of the public stadium board and one former member who said this lease extension is a bad deal for county taxpayers. Their argument is the Mariners' value has gone from $100 million in the mid-90s to about $1.5 billion now, and the county's not sharing in that increased value.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think when you start talking about an organization that has gained $1 billion in value, I think it begs the question, how much public money does it need? And I don't know the answer to that, but the Mariners have...
Does anyone know the answer to that?
The Mariners have a lot of public money, right? I mean, when Safeco Field was built, the public shared in that cost.
Something like $300 million towards Safeco Field in the beginning.
Right, and so now we're looking at another, what are they seeing, $180 million, I believe? They're seeing $180 million.
That's the first proposal, and it's in play.
Right, it's in play. And I think that actually that's the most interesting part to me, is it seemed that the organization thought that this would be a little bit more of a given, and the community outpouring against it has actually been a little bit surprising and pretty strong. And we've seen already one council member change her mind.
Jean Cole Wells.
Yep, Jean Cole Wells was one of the authors behind this proposal, and now she's saying, well, hey, maybe the community is right. Maybe this could be better spent on affordable housing, which is what they are suggesting that it would be spent on.
I just want to point out, though, that whatever deal we think King County and its taxpayers ought to get, there's still the matter of what the Mariners will agree to, and the Mariners, they say that they're not, threatening to leave, except it's kind of hanging over the whole thing, and if they think they can get an even better deal, if you think they're getting a sweet deal here, if they think they can get a sweeter deal, they could still go to Oklahoma City or whatever it is,
well,
theoretically.
If their owners still want to live happily in Seattle,
yeah,
I'm not
that.
Sure that they can.
I don't know. It's timing, right? You couldn't have picked the worst time in you know what I mean, with the crisis, the housing crisis as it is, to come up with that. I mean, I think maybe 10 years ago, you know what I mean? But right now, when we're in the middle of, all these problems, and you're bringing in another stadium, and it's in the context, I just like, oh, no. It's going to be unpopular. And I'm not against, I mean, I understand the reasoning and the economics behind it for building and doing all that sort of thing, but right now is not the time.
Win their next 10 games?
Yeah.
And then they're on the verge.
Yeah, they have to do better. The boss is saying, you cannot lose a game at this point, right?
I realize this is how sports betting scandals happen. It's like when there's money at stake and you just can't lose.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not saying, I'm just saying.
I'm old enough to remember Pete Rose, but it's one of those things that I'm not an anti-sports person, but a lot of people in my political world are. But I just feel like, wow. I mean, if you just look around you, the amount of people on the streets is just getting out of control. And you know what I mean? It's just like, you know what I mean? Something's got to be done about this. And right now, not much is being done about it. And throwing money that way is almost like, kind of like close to sinful. You know what I mean? I mean, church kind of sin. You know what I mean? It's just like... That's not.
You're worried about our souls.
I don't think Jesus would like this kind of thing. Mm. People on the streets and giving money to base millionaires and stadiums. Talk to your pastor about it. I'm telling you. I'm just like.
Well, as you said, the haggling is underway. The King County Council meets again August 29th, and there may be a vote coming up on the Safeco deal. That is our show this week. I want to thank our panel this evening. Charles Medede, a writer for the Seattle Stranger. Monica Guzman, co-founder of the Evergrade newsletter. Rachel Lerman is a tech writer for the Seattle Times. Week in Review is produced by Ahmed Al-Sadi and Allison Bruzek, and you're hearing us now because of the help of Rob Jacob Springer and Chris Odie at an event made possible thanks to our community development team, Zeki Hamid and Lisa Wang. And a special thank you to the KCLS, King County Library System, for their partnership with the Carco Theater in Renton.